1997 Stone Symposium presents session number 133, The French Mission, 1954 to 1957, a chapter from my autobiography by Levi S. Peterson, and Confessions of an Aging Hypocritical Ex-Missionary by Wayne Booth.
This is where you're going to, if you're interested in hearing two very colorful reminiscences about mission life, can you not hear me? I'll turn it. It's very fuzzy. We'll work on the sound right after this. We haven't seen Wayne Booth, but I know he's in town. I saw him 2 days ago, so we're going to assume that he'll be here, and we'll have him speak after Levi Peterson. Since they both have good, lengthy papers, but very brief introductions, I hope you know who they are. Levi Peterson is known to everyone who loves Mormon fiction. His Backslider is by many considered to be the best or one of the best Mormon novels ever written. And certainly everyone heard about the famous cowboy Jesus episode in the Backslider, which he spoke about last year. Levi is a professor of English at Weber State University, where he served for a good term as department chair. He's been a past president of the Association for Mormon Letters, and has been the workhorse of putting out their newsletter for many years. Wayne Booth is a retired distinguished professor of service professor of English at the University of Chicago. He is one of the most prominent, distinguished literary critics in the United States. He's written a slew of books, one which I read earlier this year. I really liked his, it was called The Company We Keep, An Ethics of Fiction. He's also written a book on the rhetoric of fiction, Knowledge Worth Most Worth Having, The Rhetoric of Irony, Modern Dogma, and The Rhetoric of Assent. The Company We Keep, as I said, The Vocation of a Teacher, Rhetorical Occasions, The Art of Deliberalizing, obviously it's something I don't want to do, The Handbook for True Professionals, The Art of Growing Older, which is a delightful book of quotations, and The Craft of Research. He's pulling together another book on rhetoric, of which this paper originally wrote for a chapter, and then he realized he didn't write this chapter for the same audience that the rest of the book is written for. He wrote it for a Mormon audience because it's about his mission life. So he's very happy to present it here, and we hope to publish that essay later in the year in Sunstone. So we'll hear from Levi, and then first from Wayne Booth.
Now, Albert, are you adjusting this machine? Might I wait a moment? Do I speak with the clarion voice of Moroni? Sounds all right. Good. I'm honored to be on a program with Wayne Booth. Preliminary comment, I have written about my mission in my essay, Christian by Yearning, and I hope there are sufficient new details to justify this paper. And a third, perhaps irrelevant detail, totally to my surprise, a week ago last night, my son-in-law phoned me and said, the missionaries are in my home, and they've asked me if I want to be baptized on Saturday, and I said, if my father-in-law will do it, yes. So last Saturday, I baptized my son-in-law. So I was utterly startled. God moves in mysterious ways, doesn't he? All right. So, and my title simply, Levi Peterson Reports His Mission. November 1954 to May 1957. I served in what was then a single French mission. As I began my mission, I had finished my junior year at BYU and was about to turn 21. I served 7 months in Lachaux-de-Fonds, Switzerland, as a junior companion, and then as a senior companion, 8 months in Charleroi, Belgium, and 15 months in Liège, Belgium. My first companion was Russell French from Alberta. Our quarters included an entire top floor with a large meeting hall, a kitchen, and a bedroom. There was no bathroom. We washed and shaved the kitchen sink with water heated on our two-burner stove and used the toilet on the landing below our floor. I did not have a bath or shower during the entire 7 months of my stay in Switzerland. Our proselyting consisted mostly of knocking on apartment doors. Two or three times a day, a housewife or a home-based watchmaker would invite us in and listen to our standard first lesson. We were seldom invited back. On Sunday, we tended to pastoral duties, holding conventional Mormon services for our flock of about a dozen active members, most of whom were middle-aged or elderly women. The winter of 1954-55 was said to be a mild one. It seemed otherwise to me and my companion. Storm after storm dumped snow on the Chaudiphon. Hedges of snow higher than my head lined the sidewalks, and dump trucks busily transported accumulations of snow from the streets. During a storm, we walked in the streets rather than on the sidewalks because avalanches of snow rumbled off the steep roofs with lethal force. When I awoke in the night, thudding and rumbling from far and near told me that a storm was in progress. Sometimes I woke at night to hear the clocks of the city churches strike with a haunting timbre. Momentarily at peace, I pondered the mystery and inconclusiveness of my future. I had come out prayerfully, hopeful that the doubts that had troubled my first 3 years at BYU would be allayed by the speedy witness of the Holy Spirit. The actual business of proselyting, however, reawakened my doubts. One evening after we had knocked futilely on doors for hours, we were invited in by a man with wire-rimmed spectacles and bristling gray hair, who, from a well-worn Bible, carefully scrutinized each scriptural passage my companion cited. After inviting us back twice, he and his wife concluded that the Bible did not support our claims and asked us not to return. This seemed fair to me. We had asked to explain our position, and they had allowed us to do so. Yet Mormon doctrine, as I understood it, held that they would inherit a lesser salvation by having rejected our message. I had come upon a new reason for doubt. Quite suddenly, I realized I could not believe in a deity who would condemn such obviously decent and thoughtful people to a lesser glory. With this realization, my composure crumbled. Surges of terror swept over me, and a hysterical impulse to run that I had experienced 6 months earlier at BYU returned. Despair mingled with my terror, and once again I seemed unable to perform simple and routine tasks without an enormous expenditure of inner energy. I had not stopped believing in a creative principle in the cosmos, which might be revered or even worshipped, and indeed I continued to address perfunctory daily prayers to this abstract deity throughout my mission. But I had stopped believing in providence, in miracles, and the immortality of the human soul. Hence arose my anxiety and despair, whose crippling excess struck me even then as pathological and insane. These frenzied emotions abated with time, but far from disappearing, they colored and conditioned everything I did or thought during the first half of my mission. Within less than a month of having begun my mission, I wanted to abandon it. I felt the absurdity and emptiness of a labor in whose chief rationale, the saving of souls, I no longer believed. I also found the dishonesty of my position intolerable. Advocating a faith that was no longer my own seemed a violation of my integrity. Posed against going home was my sense of having made something like a contract with the church. It struck me as irresponsible and morally flawed to repudiate my commitment. Even more important, I could not think of a single person who would be happy to see me return early. Over all other considerations loomed my mother's disappointment. I had a close and affectionate relationship with my widowed mother, whom I wrote twice a week throughout my mission, never failing to express my love and esteem. So it is no wonder that I put off the question of going home and got along as best as I could while I remained a junior companion. I must mention my journal, in which for about a year I vented my dark moods analyzing my morbid emotions, exhorting myself to courage, and pondering the hypocrisy of my position. As when I wrote, and I'm quoting from my journal, "I am often tempted to throw it all over here and live an honest life. Only pure honesty is an impossibility. But at least I'm aware I'm an insincere preacher, and it hurts me. It consoles me that I yet have a taste for honesty." I read several popular books on psychology and philosophy. Quite by accident, the German theologian, organist, and medical missionary, Albert Schweitzer, became my single most important intellectual mentor. My brother Roe mailed me the epilogue of Schweitzer's autobiography, which Roe had torn from a paperback edition of the book. I read and reread this brief, eloquent peroration on rationality and reverence for life to the point of memorizing it almost line for line. Schweitzer maintains that the remedy for the spiritual decadence into which modern humanity has fallen lies in a return to elemental thinking. Through elemental thinking, human beings will be led to affirm life and to recognize that goodness consists of altruistic service to others. Furthermore, they will see that service must not stop with the human species, but must extend to all life forms. I took Schweitzer at his word that elemental thought would lead me to truth and happiness. To the best of my ability, I reflected earnestly on the world around me. I also attempted to practice the resignation that Schweitzer said was essential by conceiving of myself. I attempted to practice it by conceiving of myself as resigned. I cannot say that I was immediately aware of any change for the better in my life, but I could see no other way for digging out of the confusion and despair which were my daily lot. Throughout my mission, Schweitzer's ideas remained the focal point of my attempt to maintain rational control over my uncooperative emotions. I will add that in time I acquired hardback English translations of four of Schweitzer's major works, including the autobiography. Less than a dozen church members, all of them women, consistently attended meetings of Le Chaux de Fonds branch. My companion and I unsuccessfully invited many inactive members to attend church, and I became aware that, around any organized center of the church, lukewarm or indifferent Mormons far outnumber the zealous ones. As I have said elsewhere, music making in Le Chaux de Fonds branch left something to be desired. While I ineptly plied the keys of our small pump organ with a single hand, Elder French kept time with an undecipherable waving of his arm, and the 10 or 12 women in attendance, most of them middle-aged or elderly, as I have said, raised a quavering cacophony of praise unto the Lord. Around New Year, a stolid, inarticulate member of about 60, Sister Gentil, ran a needle to her hand at the sewing shop where she worked and contracted a staph infection. On frequent visits to a hospital, my companion and I watched her slowly decline. One night she dreamed a raven perched on the foot of her bed. The next day she informed us we would not see her alive again, as indeed we did not. We attended her funeral as onlookers in a chapel at the city cemetery. Looming over the proceedings was a modernistic, larger-than-life painting of a grotesque crucifixion. Christ's tongue blurted from his mouth like a bloated purple balloon. It can be argued that Christ in agony reminds the faithful of his enormous sacrifice for their sins. For me, this particular rendition of Christ in agony was a reminder that I did not need of the hopelessness of my mortal condition. I resented the artist for self-indulgence, holding that the privileges of art did not excuse him for having exacerbated rather than assuaged my horror of death. In April, as his mission was nearing its end, Elder French had the satisfaction of baptizing a couple, Monsieur and Madame Catin, the sole products of our winter-long labor. On a cloudy Saturday afternoon, accompanied by a half dozen of our female flock, we went by train and bus to an unpopulated shore of Lake Neuchâtel. Clad in white, Elder French and each of the Catins, in turn, walked into the heaving gray waters of the lake. To our left, at the northern tip of the lake, was the small, picturesque city of Neuchâtel. Behind us was the timber-darkened wall of the Jura Mountains. Before us, across the lake, rose the snow-capped Alps. The wind was fresh in our faces and clouds scudded across a broken sky. I was intensely aware of the primitive in this setting. Against this wild grandeur, the rite of baptism struck me as a trifling, futile gesture. Yet I knew my associates regarded the rite as a gateway into an infinitely domesticated domain called the kingdom of God. By small perceptions of this sort, the gulf widened between me and my believing confreres. I sought covert and subliminal ways of bridging this gulf, as the following incident will illustrate. It occurred in early June 1955 on my last Sunday in Le Chaux-de-Fonds. Elder French had departed for Canada about 5 weeks earlier, and I had labored in the interim as junior companion to Larry Atwood, also from rural Alberta. On this last Sunday, I assisted my replacement, a missionary fresh from America, by translating his testimony from English into French. Standing beside him before our small congregation, I found myself uttering the French version of his testimony with a fervor that astonished me. It pleased me, I realized, to engage in that quintessential Mormon ritual of bearing a testimony, even if it was not my own. I had not lost my desire to belong to the Mormon community by becoming a disbeliever. I was transferred as a senior companion to Charleroi, Belgium, where I served for 8 months. My first junior companion was Larry Richards, and my next was Reed Merrill, a former second lieutenant in the U.S. Army. I ruled both these junior companions with a benign despotism, expecting of them the unmurmuring obedience I had accorded my senior companions. We shared quarters with another set of missionaries who made daily life more sociable. By virtue of one of the many contradictions within my personality, I had a compulsion to meet the weekly quota of 45 proselyting hours set by the mission president. Almost invariably, my companions and I were at or near the top of the entire mission in proselyting hours and cottage meetings, as sessions were called where lessons were presented. The Belgian climate alternated between rain and sunshine 2 or 3 times a day. My pants were perpetually baggy because they got wet every day below the hem of my plastic raincoat. Once in a while, I pressed my pants with no lasting effect. My coat pockets sagged with my Bible and a variety of tracts and pamphlets. I had what I esteemed a nice suit for pastoral duties on Sunday, and 2 cheap suits I had bought on sale in Salt Lake for everyday proselyting. I wore the first of these cheap suits for 15 months, then discarded it, and wore the other for 15 more. My companion and I were assigned to proselyte among the coal mining suburbs of Charleroi. Narrow, curving cobblestone streets ran between wall-to-wall houses of soot-blackened brick. High industrial walls, derricks, and hills formed from detritus and overburden marked the coal mines. The local populace spoke a blustery Walloon patois, as well as French. This being Catholic country, they decorated interior walls with crucifixes and stylized images of the bleeding heart of Jesus. Sometimes believing Catholics dismissed us for ludicrous reasons. "You want to tell me about God?" said one elderly Walloon woman. "We don't believe in God around here. We just believe in the Virgin." We also met many self-declared atheists who cynically viewed religion as an instrument of economic oppression. "Ah," said one of these, "you want to talk religion with me? He who has bread to slice gets to eat. There, that is my religion. Celui qui a pain à couper mange. Ça, c'est ma religion." That's what he said. So, he was a socialist. To my surprise, we soon had a handful of study investigators who attended our branch meetings or sent their children. I recall that 8 of the young people at our Christmas party were a direct result of my proselyting. I baptized 2 persons from the Charleroi area and was the initial contact for a husband, wife, and adopted nephew who later became that rarity among European converts at that era, stalwart permanent members of the Charleroi branch. All this happened without my bearing a testimony. In fact, I lived in dread of someone asking me directly whether I believed what I was teaching. I would have had to say no. Fortunately, no one ever asked. I believe my behavior appeared dutiful and good-humored to my close associates. I grant that I had many happy experiences in Charleroi. Inwardly, however, I felt overwhelmed by anxiety and despair. Undoubtedly, my new role as senior companion contributed to the full return of my distress, as did the perpetual clouds and industrial grime of Belgium. More and more, I considered going home. Although the obstacles to my going home that I mentioned earlier, my sense of commitment to the church and the disappointment of my relatives and friends, remained, I was now driven by desperation. It seemed my anxiety might well escalate into insanity, or my despair into a paralyzing apathy. In mid-July, I informed the mission president, Harold W. Lee, who was passing through Charleroi, that I did not believe in Mormon doctrine. The interview went very badly and left me with a permanent antipathy toward this man, a former French missionary currently on leave from his position as professor of French at BYU. I expected President Lee to agree that it was dishonest for me to proselyte. Instead, he said I had not done enough to gain a testimony. I tactlessly asserted that Mormon doctrines were based upon wishful thinking rather than upon reason. He counterattacked angrily, challenging me to specify which doctrines violated the rules of reason. At that moment, I could think of none. He went on to ridicule the humorous poems and essays I had sometimes penned on the back of my weekly reports to him, calling them foolish trash. Feeling both vanquished and affronted, the author was affronted, I began to sob, and with that, the interview ended. Within a few days, President Lee wrote me a long, not unkindly letter from Paris, assuring me he desired only to be of help. On its way was a book that would help me see the foolishness of unaided reason. This book, which I read, did not restore my inclination to believe in Mormonism, but it did undermine my already tenuous confidence that I might somehow secure a rational control over my distraught emotions. Early in August, I traveled by chartered bus with the missionaries and youth from our district to a mission-wide conference, youth conference in Paris. This was a pleasant distraction. There were concerts, folk dances, buffets, and a glorious picnic in the Bois de Boulogne, where, incredible as it may seem, I had my first taste of pâté de foie liberally spread on crusty French bread. Present at this conference was Elder Spencer W. Kimball, who undertook to interview each missionary. I informed Elder Kimball that I did not have a testimony, but I did not repeat the mistake I had made with President Lee of indicating that a testimony might be the product of wishful thinking. Elder Kimball treated me with warmth and kindness, but said that not having a testimony was a reflection on me, since any sincere person could have one. Back in Belgium, I went on with my usual work with no improvement of mood. Near the end of August, after much vacillation, I mailed a letter to President Lee asking to be released from proselyting. He replied quickly, urging me to reconsider. "You say that you do not know that the gospel is true," he wrote. "Do you know that it is false?" Why then, he went on to ask, did I consider it dishonest to preach Mormonism? And then quoting again from his letter, "I cannot think of a single principle we are called to teach," he concluded, "which is not uplifting and ennobling to the human race." I made an appointment with a Belgian psychotherapist who listened to my troubles and initially supported my plan of returning home. "You must tell your mother how unhappy you are," he said. "You will find she will not reject you." I returned to my quarters and wrote the following to my mother, and I'm quoting from a letter. "How much I dread to hurt you or lose your love. You once said you thought it better that one be insane than to lose his testimony. If you continue to meet me with that attitude, with an attitude like that, you'll get both in me." And then I went on pleading, "Mother, love me and don't worry what I believe. I'm through proselyting. I don't say I'm through with the church, but I can't stay on my mission. I shall come home to you if you want me to, but I must go where I'll be loved." I had struck the right chord with my mother, who sent back a warm, compassionate letter. Above all, indeed, I must come home to her and not think of going anywhere else upon leaving the mission. She included about a third of the fare for my ship passage and promised to mail the rest within a few days. President Lee had made it very clear I'd have to pay my own way home. I was deeply grateful for this demonstration of love and generosity. Nonetheless, I could not foresee any happy outcome to my situation. My decision to go home had intensified my anxiety. I could anticipate only painful readjustments in 1,000 former relationships. I had no plans as to what I wanted to become, what I wanted to do. Clearly, I lacked the stamina for restructuring my life outside the expectations of Mormonism. I returned to the Belgian therapist, who agreed that I should remain on my mission. "You are doing no one any harm," he said. "People are not forced to listen to you. Those who want to listen to you will get some good from it." I wrote President Lee saying I would like to talk with him again. Back came a prompt telegram saying he would be happy to discuss my problems. I wrote my mother that I had decided to stay, lifting a great burden from her shoulders. I do not remember my talk with President Lee. It probably occurred in Bern at the dedication of the new Swiss temple in early September. My decision to stay was reinforced by the dedicatory sermon and prayer of the elderly prophet and president of the church, David O. McKay, whom I had always revered. I was far from happy, of course. I was angry now, as well as anxious and depressed. I especially resented President Lee for failing to respect my disbelief. He stood in my mind as the primary enforcer of my bondage. Confined by Mormon protocol, I pleaded with him to release me, which he had no intention of doing. In retrospect, I am sure I burdened President Lee with more than his share of blame. Had I been truly independent, I would have quietly accumulated funds for my passage home, ordered my ticket, and on the day I took ship, mailed a letter to President Lee informing him of my departure. For many years, I nursed the fancy that someday I would urinate on his grave. I'm sorry to say that even now the idea has some appeal to me. And others who know him say he was just the kindest and mildest person. But so it goes. As I close the account of my Charlotte period, I will note that my companions and I often returned to visit people who were lonely or ill, even though we judged them to be poor prospects for conversion. One whom we visited was an obese elderly woman whose husband loathed her and whose only child, a son, was emigrating to America. She often asked whether suicide was permissible. I said no, and read passages from the Sermon on the Mount to her. We similarly visited a former miner who had been mistakenly given a severe caustic at a mine infirmary. The caustic had eaten away part of his esophagus and diaphragm, and his heart lay, literally, among his entrails, as he proved by making me grasp the throbbing lump through the wall of his abdomen. He said French doctors had promised him comfortable quarters if he would allow them to observe him. He refused their offer, fearing they would kill him. An ironic worry for a man who repeatedly expressed a wish to die. While in Charleroi, I enjoyed a visit from my brother Lynn on furlough from the U.S. Army in Germany. We went out to dinner together, slept as guests at a member's house, and took a bicycle ride in the countryside where we ate cheese and fruit bought along the way. While we lolled on a grassy bank, a tiny gnat somehow imprisoned itself inside the viewfinder of the snapshot camera I had recently bought. During the night after Lynn departed, I awoke worrying about the imprisoned gnat. Remembering Schweitzer's principle of reverence for life, I rose and cracked the plastic rim around the viewfinder, allowing the gnat to escape. Ruined the camera, but the gnat lived. My first baptism, performed in December 1955, was something less than a spiritual experience. The convert was Madame Lejeune, a portly, square-jawed woman of about 50 who had to hide her connections with Mormonism from her jealous, domineering husband. I do not know how she secured a letter of consent from him, which was required in those days for a married woman. This baptism took place in a swimming pool in Brussels, where we went by train early one Sunday morning. On to the square, I said the baptismal prayer and attempted to immerse her. Survival instincts took possession of her, and she threshed and kicked. The witnesses declared she had not been entirely immersed and required me to repeat the process. It was not until the fourth try, when desperation overcame decorum, that I fell athwart her with my own body and bore her to the bottom. And that's why in the backslider I had Frank tell Jeremy when they baptized the dog Rupert, if you don't get all of him under, he goes to hell. God will send him to hell. All right. At any rate, going on. In the middle of January 1956, I was transferred to Liège, Belgium, where I served the remaining 15 months of my mission. My new companion, Philip Smith, already spoke French from a residence in Beirut with his parents and was very eager to proselyte. We liked each other instantly, and after an initial period of discomfort over his unthinking intrusions upon my authority as senior companion, I swallowed my pride and accepted an equal sharing of decision-making between us. We were assigned to proselyte in Outremeuse, an ancient crowded island formed in the middle of Liège by the Meuse River. Many of the residents were unemployed or elderly and living on welfare or scant pensions. We rarely saw children in the narrow, twisting streets. The paint on interior walls was grimy and peeling, and stairwells smelled of cooking odors and sometimes of urine. These people were not well-read or acquainted with current affairs. Some of them seemed incapable of grasping that we wanted to convert them. These tended to regard us simply as roving ambassadors of goodwill. They seemed more prone than any other population I proselyted among to engage in that old ploy of letting us enter for a first lesson, agree to a second, and then fail to be at home when we returned. Although my companion and I continued to be at or near the top of the mission in proselyting hours and cottage meetings, our 6 months of labor in Outremeuse yielded no harvest. There were no baptisms and no investigators who attended church more than two or three times. Elder Smith and I were fortunate enough to rent a cheerful, newly finished room on Rue de Compiègne, only a few doors below the Mormon chapel. I was also cheered by the sociability of the large Liège branch, whose chapel, one of only two in the entire mission, had a recreation hall with a theatrical stage and a baptismal font in its basement. Another pair of male missionaries lived near us, and a pair of female missionaries lived across town. The other three branches of the Liège district were close enough that we often mingled with members and missionaries there. The Liège district was also the site of the mission basketball team, whose competition with Belgian teams brought favorable publicity. My companion was a member of this team. I practiced with it and attended most of its games. Within a month or two of arriving in Liège, I underwent a major change of mood, becoming predominantly happy with only brief periods of anxiety and depression. I attributed this improvement of mood to my practice of resignation, as I had grasped this principle from my reading of Albert Schweitzer. I was pleased to believe that at last my attempt to reason myself into happiness had paid dividends. In retrospect, I attribute my happiness to other causes. I have mentioned the congeniality that existed between me and my companion, the cheering aspect of our room, and the sociability of the large Liège branch. I also served as district Sunday school superintendent, which required that I travel among the four branches of the district on Sundays. Between proselyting, practicing basketball, preparing lessons and sermons, and attending meetings in one branch or another, I was very busy and less focused on my own emotions. Also contributing to my happiness was a clandestine romance with an outspoken, volatile 18-year-old member of Liège branch, named Henriette Ring, whose Jewish parents had perished in a Nazi camp during World War II. Because we lived near the chapel, Henriette recruited my companion and me to help her decorate the recreation hall for a number of social activities for the youth. The result was that, despite my previously acquired understanding that romantic love is a mercurial and untrustworthy emotion, I fell in love with Henriette. Prohibited by mission rules from expressing my feelings, I existed in a splendid frustration. When Henriette arranged to migrate to Utah some months in the future, I began to worry that I would never have an opportunity to make my feelings known to her. There could be no harm, I reasoned, in making them known by means of a letter. Around the middle of May, I wrote a letter, wrestled with myself for days, then finally dropped it into a mailbox. That very night, I found her enthusiastic reply in our mailbox. Thereafter, Henriette and I exchanged a weekly letter, her letters coming without a return name or address. My unsuspecting companion also assisted by generally leaving it to me to gather our mail. I was mistaken in my assumption that there would be no other violation of mission rules. One evening at a church social, Henriette stopped me on the dark landing between the recreation hall and the chapel and kissed me passionately. Soon many other opportunities for physical intimacy presented themselves. Eventually, she asked me whether I would marry her, and I said I would. I dutifully wrote my mother that she was to have a Belgian daughter-in-law. Undecided, uncertain whether I could adapt to Henriette's outspoken personality, I urged her to anticipate a long engagement after my mission was over so that we could get to know each other. She, for her part, wanted to get married immediately after my mission. She saw no danger whatsoever. Being in love was all that mattered. She was not at all perturbed by the confession of disbelief, which I now felt obliged to include in my letters to her. In fact, she confidently predicted that her own fervent testimony would reignite my faith. I felt very guilty about all this, and my guilt increased with the approach of a visit of all the French missionaries to the Swiss temple in early August. I dreaded the outright lie I would have to tell the mission president during my temple interview. On the Sunday before my departure for Switzerland, an elderly member, Sister Nave, stopped me on the sidewalk after sacrament meeting and said, "Elder Peterson, you think people do not notice your attentions to Henriette Ring, but people have noticed. It is only a matter of time and the mission president will transfer you to another city far away. It will be a disgrace to you and your good mother." I was grateful for this woman's sincere desire to help me. I traveled to Switzerland determined to reform my conduct, on basis of which I told the mission president that I was worthy of attending the temple. I attended perhaps 10 sessions. For many reasons, I did not relish the ceremony, yet I tried to maintain a respectful attitude toward it. Henriette and I engaged in no further physical intimacy following my return from Switzerland. I was aware by then that I was no longer in love with her and felt sure we could not construct a harmonious marriage. Honesty required that I inform her at once. Fearing that she might expose me to the mission president, I chose to wait till my mission was over. She migrated to Utah in September, and we went on exchanging letters. Upon returning home, I called on her, and in a sad, brief interview, ended our relationship. In the meantime, things changed in Liège. Within days of our return from Switzerland, Elder Smith was made a senior companion, and he and his junior companion moved into the apartment of the other pair of male missionaries who were transferred elsewhere. By virtue of seniority, I inherited the transferred missionaries' prime investigators and favorable proselyting area on the heights overlooking Liège. It was here, amid pleasant middle-class neighborhoods, that I engaged in my final 9 months of proselyting. I had 3 junior companions during this period, Robert Johnson, Jay Fitt, and Robert Hansen. I felt that I got along reasonably well with Elder Johnson and Elder Fitt. It was otherwise with Elder Hansen, who was uncooperative in the extreme. One day he tried to spill me from my bicycle. Another day he and I engaged in a fist fight in our room. Although the fight was a draw, his demeanor improved for about a week. This was one of the few times I ever found the boxing classes I had taken at BYU to be useful. In closing, I will mention another memorable personality from the final months of my mission, Denise Gratson, who was handed on to me by the transferred missionaries. A docile, compassionate wife and mother of about 45 years of age, Madam Gratson had the makings of the archetypal convert to Mormonism, destined to undergo enormous sacrifices for her new religion. She and her husband, who was still a devout Catholic, came from large, zealous Catholic families, and he was under considerable pressure from both families to employ the coercions that Belgian law allowed a husband. Convinced by the previous missionaries that she must resolutely press forward with becoming a Mormon, Madame Gratson seemed relieved by my assurance that the harmony of her home was more important than her immediate baptism. I have never felt more nearly worshipped than by this sincere and generous woman. She quickly adopted the custom of feeding my companion and me a mid-afternoon dinner when we arrived to teach her a lesson each week. I recall one of her envious sons shouting as we arrived, "Voilà les grands bouffeurs! There come the great gluttons." That's how it translates. She made
evening for their meal. They stood by hungrily, and she fed us well. She did our laundry free of charge, and when she delivered it to us on Saturday, she also gave us a pound of butter. To my surprise, her husband eventually allowed the children to attend our primary, and at last he even gave his approval for his wife's baptism, stating simply that he recognized her right to decide for herself. A few days before I baptized her, she said to my mother, in a letter which I translated, that she hoped for an ultimate witness to the truth of Mormonism at the moment of her baptism. I do not know whether that witness was given to her. I wondered at this time whether she might not, after all, accomplish the impossible and slowly, inch by inch, convert her husband. Without question, she needed her husband's full participation in order to find a happy permanent place in what was, even in Liège, a typically sparse and fitful Mormon mission field community. It is typical of the missionary experience that I was not present to observe the failure of this miracle, for within a couple of weeks of her baptism, my mission ended. On the Sunday I left Liège in May of 1957, Madame Grayson embraced me in the foyer of the chapel and, with tears brimming in her eyes, said, "Je vous aime tant," I love you so much. I believed she would never forget me. On this day of my departure, I was given many other demonstrations of respect and love by the members of the branch and by my investigators. The congregation sang a farewell song which utterly destroyed my composure, and my own farewell remarks were blubbered rather than spoken. Our mutual assertions to the contrary, I knew it very unlikely I would ever see any of these people again. My weeping was a measure of my mission's significance. The anxiety and despair of my first 15 months were long forgotten. My anger over the coercion that had kept me on my mission was suspended. My carefully nursed disbelief seemed irrelevant. The interest I had found in observing the Belgian scene, the warm friendships I had formed with missionaries, members, and investigators, the enlargement of my abilities and understanding, combined to make me regret the ending of a remarkable era in my life. I cannot refrain from adding this postscript to the account of my mission. I returned briefly to the scene of my mission some 22 years later during the summer of 1979, while on a month-long tour of Europe with my wife and daughter. From the Liège train station, I telephoned Madame Grayson, identifying myself and inviting her to meet us for lunch at Place Saint-Lambert. She said, in an aged and weary voice, that she was tending grandchildren and would find it difficult to come to lunch. She remembered me only vaguely. Her husband, she said, had run the Mormons off long ago. I thanked her and prepared to hang up. At the last instant, her voice brightened, and she said perhaps she could arrange to meet us for lunch after all. By then it had struck me as the cruelest thing I could do to revive this woman's memory of Mormonism. I said a gentle goodbye and hung up. Thank you.
Well, we have a situation here. Wayne Booth hasn't shown up, and we're not sure. We know he's in town. He picked up an extra copy of his paper a couple of days ago. The session hasn't been changed from the preliminary program, so we hope he knows the right time, but maybe he'll show up later and got his times mixed up, or I don't know. Well, I hope not. He'd quickly find no one down there. Would you want us to read the paper? I'm probably not the best person to do it with my voice. Someone else who's good who would like to? You want to, Levi? Great. I'll keep my eye out for him in case he arrives late.
It may be a little long. You want to skip some places. I'm going to trade microphone.
I may not know.
Fuzzy.
Well, I'm dismayed but also honored to read Wayne Booth's manuscript. I will tell you that the session ends at 12:45, correct? And so we have about 35 minutes. The paper is 40 pages long. That's no, I propose to read about 15 pages and then read the final 10. But let's see. Let's go with it. All right. Confessions of an Aging Hypocritical Ex-Missionary, Wayne C. Booth. Until I was far into my teens, I was a devout, utterly unquestioning Mormon. My parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles were all visibly, audibly, aggressively devout, all except one uncle, a smoker, who was referred to as a black sheep. For our family, non-Mormons were beyond the pale, to be tolerated, of course, even treated kindly if they behaved themselves, viewed perhaps as potential converts, but never courted or married, never even visited socially. They were certainly not destined, like us, to enter the celestial kingdom. We knew that in the next life, those lost souls would not even be allowed to come near us as we all continued our eternal progression, pursuing knowledge and righteousness, concepts that, when defined correctly, turned out to be the same thing. Of course, it was true that then as now, that those heathen, those infidels, those violators of the word of wisdom, would not all be consigned to eternal fire and brimstone. Fire and brimstone of the kind emphasized by those devilish Protestant sects that Joseph Smith had repudiated was mentioned only when we talked of the genuine backsliders, former saved ones, now lost, the total number of whom could be counted on the fingers of one hand. All the others would be granted the right to continue progression, to continue progressing. The comfortable point for us was that they would all start far below us, down there in those lower ranks, and remain forever behind. What I remember was most important to me was that the non-Mormon or non-devout males down there would have no hope for what I had a strong hope for if I kept my nose clean. Becoming a god of another world, the god of another world, accompanied by some pious female helpmate. Meanwhile, here and now, all those others were so far beneath us that it was dangerous even to get near them. I can remember feeling scared to walk too close to the one non-Mormon church in my hometown, American Fork. I would always cross the road and walk on the other side to avoid contamination, and I was thankful that we lived in another ward, far from that wicked place. In short, until my first questioning began at about 14, I was 100% devotee of what might be called an exclusivist or particularist anti-ecumenical version of Mormonism. That boy that would perhaps these days be called a fundamentalist. The word wasn't in our vocabulary, I'm quite sure. Born and reared in the pre-Darwinian 19th century, as you might say, he was for about 15 years unaware of what had been happening to Western thought from long before he was born. Where am I now? Well, I'm still a Mormon, but one who always has to put quotation marks around most of his religious commitments. The marks that always translated not as disbelief, but as, allow me, my own definitions. The pious young believer and I have engaged in a variety of dialogues for going on 7 decades now. As my beliefs and unbeliefs have shifted about, the debates have, of course, changed ground. At times I've in effect treated the boy as a stupid oaf, and he's treated me as a lost soul. Sometimes he has been so shocked by my ideas, and even more by how low I rank coffee or wine drinking on the scale of sins, that he has simply and angrily cast me off, even as I would lament his naive commitment to silly superstitions and destructive prejudices. By now, though, as he and I face the many conflicting religious and anti-religious conflicts flooding our world, the distance between us seems to me far less, and the need to get together, in spite of his remaining conviction that this is impossible, seems even greater. After all, I tell him, many of my admired religious friends now talk about an apocalyptical ending fully as confidently as he does, and some of them even have in mind, as he does, a second coming. If we can just probe space far enough and vigorously enough, we'll find some planet to escape to when this one collapses. I wrote that sentence long before the Heaven's Gate self-massacre in the spring of 1997. It was based in part on my memory of my father's patriarchal blessing, given him probably before World War I, which had told him that he would live to see the second coming. When I was 4, I heard either Mama or Daddy shouting, "There she is," pointing to a black-skirted woman bicycling past the house. "Who is she?" I remember asking. "She's the woman who predicts the world will end tomorrow." "Will it?" They said no, but I was scared. Then when 2 years later my father died, the family had to perform a lot of hermeneutical reconstruction of meanings for live and see, but we still knew that the end was nigh. Isn't it time, I now ask my young self, to probe beneath the superficial verbal differences to the true grounds of our strongest convictions? Isn't our real assignment as we approach the new millennium to discover that we share and then decide, probing our differences, just which ones can be cast aside, to discover what we share and then decide, probing our differences, just which ones can be cast aside? He's a bit more open these days to that suggestion, but for many decades he viewed my profession of commitment to various liberal versions and virtues of Mormonism as simply a hypocritical disguise for genuine betrayal. And he quotes here, "You're betraying Grandma and Grandpa Booth and Grandma and Grandpa Clayson and great-grandfather and great-grandmother Hawkins and all the Chipman pioneers. You're blaspheming the heritage they all gave us. You're casting aside the very testimonies that I have borne in fast meeting at least ten times already. You'll make it so we'll not be allowed to talk with any of the family in the next world, even though you list yourself as a Mormon in Who's Who. You're not a Mormon anymore. You don't even believe that Mormons have the only fully true church. You say you believe in the divinity of Jesus Christ and in Joseph Smith as a true prophet, but I know that you mean all that as something covered by a word you just learned in school. It's metaphor for you, not literal truth. You're just plain hypocritical," end quote. And off he rides on his bicycle to go to a Boy Scout meeting or to collect fast day donations or to remind the other boys in his deacon's quorum that they must attend both meetings Sunday, otherwise the other quorum will win the contest for best attendance. Sometimes now I do manage, though, to entice him into a real discussion about what beliefs we shall still share, the kind of discussion this article is designed to further. My claim in those discussions is that he and I still share the most important truths, the ones that are really, they're most truly religious. That is a radical claim that continues to disturb him. Quote, "I don't see how you can make that claim, and I don't see how we can even discuss it when you arrogantly reject what I know to be true. I just don't want to talk with you," end quote. But I go on arguing, as I shall argue here, that beneath our differences, he and I still share common ground that is far more important than our differences. In other words, as I've talked, not just with that young fundamentalist, but with various enemies and other selves over the years, I've been learning to practice the kind of rhetorical practice that these days I risk labeling with a neologism, rhetorology. Not rhetorical persuasion, but rather a systematic ecumenical probing of the essentials to be found shared by the rival rhetorics in any dispute, whether about religion or about other important matters. Though rhetorology shares many features with other dialogical efforts, what it perhaps most resembles is political diplomacy. But unlike skillful diplomats, rhetorologists do not just try to discover the true rival basic commitments and then bargain, nor do they just tolerate in a spirit of benign relativism. Instead, they search together for true grounds and then labor to decide how those grounds dictate a change of mind about more superficial beliefs. Any genuine rhetorologist entering any fray is committed to the possibility of conversion to the enemy camp. For decades, I've been especially interested in the quarrels between those who specifically label themselves as religious and who dismiss all atheists as inherently benighted, and many of those who call themselves atheists or unbelievers and who dismiss all religious talk as nothing more than superstition. As I have tried to write a book on that subject, my imagined conversations with that lively, probing young believer have come to seem more and more important. The pursuit of such a rhetorology has become for me, in itself, a vocation that could be called religious, a kind of faith in, or unspeakable conviction of, the ultimate value of pursuing understanding and improved dialogue about shared fundamental values. The validity of such a faith could never be proved with hard logic or scientific evidence. It is as much a faith as any overt commitment to a church, but in my rhetorical terms, it is a rational faith, one that can be genuinely supported by careful argument of the right kind, even though it can easily be described as naive or flatly absurd, according to some narrow notions of rational proof. There are obviously no scientific or strictly logical proofs for the importance of ecumenical pluralistic probing, but I can find no good reasons to doubt its service to genuine religion. Skeptics concerning this special kind of religious pursuit are found in every field and in most religious groups, and they always find good evidence for their skepticism. Our world is full of evidence showing that attempts at dialogue between contrasting faiths fail more often than they succeed. Think of the failed conversations going on among, or flatly denied by, Orthodox, Conservative, and Reformed Jews. Indeed, many philosophers and politicians and defenders of religion will claim that there can be no genuine discussion about religion between a pluralist like me and that 14-year-old religious dogmatist. Religious dispute is inherently the kind that goes nowhere. As the self-proclaimed atheist Richard Rorty put it not long ago, religion should be privatized. It should be kept out of the public square. It is bad taste to bring religion into discussions of public policy because all overtly religious groundings are irrational, refuted by the Enlightenment that he claims still to embrace. In short, I'm sure that for him, the faith undergirding this article is absurd. Why should anyone persist in such a faith, looking back on a lifetime and out at a world, both of which seem to exhibit more failures than successes in the search for common spiritual ground? Within the Latter-day Saint community, one seems to see more and more drawing of sharp, impermeable lines, less and less embrace of the notion that religious devotion expresses itself best when believers get together and think through the grounds of their belief. Of course, there's no way of proving that the lines are sharper now than when I was young. But it's clear that throughout my lifetime, most Mormons would be skeptical about my claim that the young literalist and this old metaphorist belong, in the deepest sense, to the same church. Such a claim might well lead in hundreds of directions. For the rest of this article, I'll pursue just one of them, with the question, where did I pick up a faith that is as difficult to defend as is the faith in what I'm calling rhetorology, not just ecumenicism, but the pursuit of ecumenical dialogue? Only recently have I begun to suspect that it was the direct result of my 2 years as a confused, probing, often troubled Mormon missionary. After 5 or 6 years of increased reading and questioning in private conferences with pious but unorthodox teachers and heated arguments with orthodox and unforgiving authorities, the 20-year-old Wayne Booth, argumentative and increasingly skeptical about many Mormon claims, and even more troubled by the behavior of many saints, surprised a lot of people by accepting a mission call. As he put it to skeptical friends at BYU, but never to the church authorities, he was not going out to make converts, but not to get people ducked into the baptismal water, but to do good in the world and to start liberalizing the church from within. Did that feel hypocritical? Yes, indeed, some of the time. At the key moment of decision went like this, reconstructed nearly 30 years later in 1969 as I wrestled with my religious doubts and convictions in the light of my 18-year-old sons having been killed by a car. Scene. The northwest corner of the Brigham Young University farmland where the head sluice gates lie, sluice gates that I manipulate as I irrigate the farm through the long summer hours, reading my pocket Play-Doh as I wait at the end of the furrows for the water to arrive. This evening, Professor Polson has happened by, seen me pulling up a head gate, and stopped his car nearby. After finishing my simple task, I go to his car, place one rubber-booted foot on his fender, and we start talking. We talk and talk, talk on through the beautiful sunset into the twilight, slapping mosquitoes, talking, mainly about the church and my doubts. Polson speaking. Don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. You keep leaping ahead into areas you know nothing about. The fact that some church leaders are dishonest or unjust doesn't mean that the church is valueless. Every institution, including every church, has some immoral leaders. Surely you're not going to relapse into the position that because the church is claimed to be divinely led and its leaders are clearly not divine, it must be valueless when judged in human terms. Wayne. No, but I don't see any reason to. And Polson again, interrupting. You shouldn't be looking for reasons to. You should be looking only for reasons not to. Here you are, raised in a marvelously vital tradition, surrounded by an astonishing number of good, intelligent people who have found a way to organize their lives effectively. You come along and ask them for reasons to do what they are doing. What you should ask for before giving up anything they offer you is reasons not to go along. Wayne. But I just can't stand even sitting in church without speaking up when somebody talks nonsense. Last Sunday they were talking about personal devils, and some of them really believed that stuff. Polson. Well, you know what I've always said when some authority grills me on that one. Of course I believe in personal devils. All my devils are personal. It's unimportant what you call it, devils or personal quests or temptation or schizophrenia. The 55-year-old widower, Czech age, hated... Oh, that's Wayne's note to himself. The 55-year-old widower, hated by many students for his nagging discipline in the classroom, mistrusted by the church and university authorities, owner of the best collection of books on Mormon history. He has previously invited me into his basement to have a look at his collection of forbidden sources. Talks on into the dark, feeling lucky, I have no doubt, to have with him one of those rare students who really loves discussing deep questions for hours on end. Of course, I cannot see the boy. I only feel myself standing there, chilling a bit in my wet socks, tired after 20 hours of irrigating, not hard labor admittedly, but still, changing from one foot to the other, and exhilarated beyond description. This is what life can be. This is one of the great times. I'll stay here forever if only he'll go on talking. Polson. What you should be doing, instead of trying to undermine other people's belief, is discovering beliefs that you yourself can live by. And you'll find most of them being taught right in the church by the people you're attacking. That's why I keep saying, show me a better church. I'm not determined to stay with this one if you'll find me another one that does as much good and that has fewer corrupt leaders, a better attitude on race or whatnot. And then Wayne. But that's not good enough. Don't we have the right to hope for an institution that is at least honest with itself? I long for a cause that I can give myself to fully as the believers, my father and mother, my grandparents, could give in earlier times. Polson. Well, I'm sure you can find it if you want to badly enough. You all know Polson, professor of psychology at BYU for many years. In this dialogue. Polson, well, I'm sure you can find it if you want to badly enough. Because all you have to do is just put your mind to rest and let your emotions take over. Almost any church can easily become that to you if you want it to badly enough. The Mormons have plenty of members like that. All causes do. What they lack is devoted men, I'm pretty sure he did not add women, who still are willing to think, not just be carried away by sentimentality. What they really need is a core of missionaries who know everything that's wrong with the church and who don't care because they know that it can be an instrument for good in their hands. In the dark now, the moon not quite ready to rise, the stars bright as they never seemed to be in 1969, the old man's gray hair is faintly visible inside the car, the deep, thoughtful voice pours out into the night. His dirty fingernails are now invisible, and there's nothing but prophetic voice and silver glow. Wayne, do you mean to suggest that I should go on a mission? Polson, why not? If you could work not to get the people under the water in the greatest possible number, but to take them where you find them and help them to grow, why not? Can you think of a better way to spend 2 years than setting out to help other people with no concern about your own welfare or future? That's what the missionary system is at its best. Oh, yes, I admit that it seldom works at its best. Most of the boys are so badly prepared at 19 or 20 that they couldn't even do a good job in the narrow definition of making converts. But you might if you worked hard, if you thought hard, and if you keep from worrying too much about your own reputation. You might make a real difference for a lot of people. Just take, for example, the whole question of charity among backsliders. Who has that in charge in our present setup? None of the other missionaries will be working on that, and you might. Why not? So at 10 o'clock, they break up, and a few days afterwards, Wayne Clayson Booth accepts the call. Back here in the late 90s, it is clear that he thus landed himself in rhetorical waters far more turbulent than he could ever have predicted. Even Polson, who had served as a missionary before doing the historical research that for him dissolved the gold plates, could not have predicted that this second-generation Mormon liberal would predicted what this second-generation Mormon liberal would encounter. From day one, he had to deal with shock concerning differences between his beliefs and what every missionary believes. His experience in the temple ceremony was so distressing that he almost gave up and went home, and he recorded in great detail the bloodthirsty oaths and other absurdities that were much more prominent in the ceremony then than now. Polson and others had warned him that he would be shocked, but they had understated it. And then he found himself tracting door to door, struggling to reconcile what the manual said he should teach with what he believed to be the best spiritual food for himself, for his companions, and for the prospects who turned up. Now, living daily with companions and supervisors who considered what he called the superstitions to be more important than love or charity or any of the other virtues, he found himself inevitably pursuing a practice that he would no doubt have cringed to hear called rhetorology. He became not a mere practitioner of persuasion, a rhetor, trying to win converts to his views, and not the mere student of how people persuade, a rhetorician, but a rhetorologist. How can I reconcile their rhetoric with mine? Their surface codes with what I'm sure are shared beliefs that are more important than all those conflicting literal claims. He got to be pretty good at some amateur versions of rhetorology, sometimes in ways that his younger self, still surviving his conscience, damned as hypocritical. He somehow didn't get far on liberalizing the whole church from within, but he did learn how to pray in public in a language that accommodated the literalists without violating his own meditations. He learned how to give sermons that woke some people up, undermined their cliches, and led them to dwell on the central virtues and limits of Mormonism without leading, most of the time, to angry attacks against him for unorthodoxy. He learned how to learn from the Orthodox what was really valuable in their orthodoxy. He did so well at it that the liberal mission president, Leo J. Muir, absorbed in Egyptian numerology rather than rhetorology, chose him as mission secretary at headquarters in Chicago. He even felt some sense of triumph as he returned home in January of 1944, at last facing the draft. How I wish I had a transcript of the celebratory talk he gave at his homecoming sacrament meeting. That cheerful picture of what he learned about how to deal with rival rhetorics is much simpler and much more cheerful than the picture I find reading over his journals of the time. I find they are full as they are of vast swings from up to down and back again. Sometimes he is in despair. Sometimes he finds himself cursing under his breath when listening to prayers that he considers not just stupid but wicked. Only rarely does he talk openly in the daily accounts of the rhetorical problems he faces as he deals with the surrounding orthodoxy. He slogs it out for 2 solid years, much of the time wrestling in his journal over the question of just which remaining religious ideas, if any, he can embrace. Like the history of many probers through their youth, his account reveals great swings from doubt to belief and back again, sometimes sounding absurd to me now, sometimes a bit pathetic, sometimes fairly impressive, depending partly on my mood as I reread. Often the journal reveals conflicts between the gods of scientific truth and the rival gods of moral and political service. Quote, if you care about the truth of things, I find him implying again and again, you ought to quit this mission. If you care about human welfare, now or in the future, if you care about helping people, you should continue. And meanwhile, his continuing passion for literature and music and art tempt him almost daily away from attending to either truth or service. Most striking to me now are the ways in which he labors to reconcile diverse views of religion and science. When he reads Bergson's Creative Evolution, for example, a book then touted by liberal believers, his response is that of a would-be believer rescued from the seas of doubt. And then quoting an entry from his journal, September 5, 1942. Bergson is magnificent, especially where he is obviously wrong or only guessing. Bergson is righter than most philosophers. Bergson is a man after my own heart. He says that evolution does not come about through natural selection, but through the existence of an original vital impetus, which is consciousness or life pushing upward against materiality, which naturally is descending. Through intuition and not through intellect, we can discover this elan vital. There is no limit in time to the impetus. It may even transcend death. It is a becoming, as is all movement, and the aim of philosophy would be to turn inward toward this becoming in order to apprehend, in order to follow its present results. And that ends the quotation from his diary summarizing Bergson. The scientific in him, he had begun at BYU intending to become a chemist, of course raises doubts. Bergson carries himself away in his enthusiasm, he writes in his journal, and uses specious reasoning instead of real proof. But what is palpable is the relief he feels at having found a reasonable argument for a new version of religious commitment. One of my reasons for liking Bergson, he writes, is the beautiful way in which he suits my recent conversion to spirituality, my reversion from materialism. As he goes on reading Bergson and mystics like Aldous Huxley and religious psychologists like Jung, his joy is palpable as he experiences a feeling of oneness and sympathy for all life, and especially all human life, the feeling of a creating, impelling force greater than oneself. Elder Booth reports his pride in being able to do so without violating the tiny bits of irreligious or scientific knowledge that he thinks he has. But the threats of hard reason are never far removed. Quoting again, increased knowledge will surely supplant or modify much of Bergson's metaphysics. His jet of life or energy or whatever it must be, must be little more than pure fancy. Quite probably his big idea of the consciousness and its instrumentality on matter is faulty. But that consciousness now transcends matter and can transcend it more in the future will not be, but that consciousness now transcends matter will not be refuted, I hope. In entry after entry, I find him struggling to reduce the dissonance between religious belief and rationally defensible belief. Armed with Bergson and Plato and later Jung, who says that he has never known a psychological problem that was not essentially a religious problem, Elder Booth can sometimes, with a clear conscience, liberalize whatever seems ready to be liberalized as it comes his way. And quoting again from his journal, last night, Clive Bradford, fellow missionary, and I had a long talk about the church, philosophy, the war, the missionary system. Brad is an intelligent fellow, original in his thinking. I've had him reading Hawking and Will Durant and James' varieties of religious experience. That's the tone of a young would-be wise man spreading his mature harmonies to the world. The best critics of such pomposities was his favorite mission companion, Marion Duff Hanks. Duff, who provided brilliant challenges to most of his ideas, radical and conservative, and who later provided the best possible model of what it means to be a totally devoted and active, yet liberal, Mormon. As everyone who knows Duff well says, he should have been made one of the 12. Meanwhile, as the idiosyncratic mission drags on, the self-divided missionary takes refuge many hours each week in literature and music, sometimes with conscious reference to religious problems, but often simply lost in the joys of art. but almost every day he wrestles with religious questions. He says that he has discovered that every person is a walking bundle of ineffability, a bit like God himself, by which he apparently means that the existential richness of each person finally escapes any attempt at description. Forget about conceptual problems, essentially unresolvable, and revel in the riches God's world offers you. He reads Ulysses. You can picture it, the novel Ulysses. You can picture it, reader, that young missionary, moving from Orthodox testimony meetings to Joyce's night town scenes and back to the meetings. The most clever, most intellectual, most sophisticated book I've ever read, as he writes in his journal. And going on with a quote, "Of course, by my definition of intellectual and sophistication, I exclude practically everyone before the 19th century, though in reality they may require more downright intelligence, the great ones, than any of the moderns." Meanwhile, he goes on wrestling with the church that he had hoped to rescue. As his long first year draws to a close, he gets the idea of organizing the liberals. Quote, "If all the so-called Mormon liberals could organize, some beneficial changes could be wrought. Might even be just plain made without having to be wrought, but I'm sure it would be more effective if they were wrought." And then in a long, fascinating paragraph, most of which I'll spare you, he describes the differences among liberals and concludes that, quoting, "The group who think as I do probably numbers no more than 20 at the most, and of course this is the right way, and all the others will eventually come to our position, of course. Yes, we are a hodgepodge, the larger group of liberals, of malcontents, and will probably never get together." We have about 6 minutes. Shall I continue reading? Okay, I will read to the end of the period. By the middle of his first year, the original reasons for becoming a missionary has grown rather dim. But the steady battle for intellectual freedom goes on, unofficial, never clearly formulated. In late December, 11 months in, putting off the critique of Ulysses, the boy decides to tabulate and mull over my various interests, those are his missionary words, and he proceeds to do so in 3 single-spaced typed pages. After some preliminary efforts at humor, one page, he finally begins what, from the perspective here, could almost be described as a dialogue among 3 rival gods: truth or reality, goodness or human progress, individual and social, and beauty, the religion of art, then dominating the lives of many he most admired. And then, quoting from those pages, "My primary interest is to get closer to reality, or could I say I am interested in philosophy. I could profitably spend my whole time giving myself a rigorous philosophical education, working out a stable personal philosophical position, getting at the truth of this mysticism business. This is partly intellectual curiosity, but more, it is something akin to aesthetic yearnings. I want something, the right, real thing, to replace the religion philosophy of my childhood. I think that the mystics and the humanists and the scientific materialists all have the vital things to say to me, and I wish I could be with them constantly. Among my deepest interests is my passion, please let me call it that and don't laugh, for great fiction and poetry. For instance, I could spend my whole time reading novels and training myself to write them, or at least to criticize them intelligently. Also, in the quest for reality, in the quest for reality category is science, the much abused and much misunderstood bane and joy of all modern thinkers. Really, my first intellectual love, it still looms large in my horizon. I leave it alone. When you spend time reading this book, you just can't be reading that book far more than I should, because certainly with all my mystical leanings, I must keep a firm grip on the genuine truth which science discovers. Less ethereal, less theoretical is my interest in politics. I'm subject to spasms of political conscience, the feeling that I should go actively into some liberal movement." And then a note from the modern Wayne, "And then, after adding music and art to these passions, he makes a slight bow to his missionary work," quoting again, "Missionary work, I neglect it horribly, always able to justify myself by saying, "Well, I'm really not ready for mature missionary work yet. What do I know? What can I teach?" And so the debates among the rival gods go on, each aspiring to replace or at least subdue features of the god he had once embraced without question. Sometimes he sounds like an arrogant prophet of the Enlightenment, with no self-doubt whatever. But more often, it's a dance back and forth, up and down. Quoting now, January 4th, 1943. T.Y., his cousin T.Y. Booth, and I are still arguing somewhat futilely about the gospel. I find myself totally unable to convince him that when he persists in believing every deal of the Joseph Smith story, he is being gullible and intellectually immature. I cannot muster in sufficient force the long string of reasons for my present opinions to convince him. His difficulty is that he thinks he has passed through the doubting period, that he has reached the final firm ground of belief, and that I am where he was when he doubted. That is totally untrue. At the time he doubted, it was merely youthful questioning, curiosity, showiness, the same kind I experienced at about the same time. He cannot see that the unfirm ground on which I now tread is an entirely different intellectual bog from the one he once wallowed in. He says to me, "What is your concept of God?" I can't give it to him clearly. He says, "What kind of future life do you envision if the Mormon position is unacceptable to you?" I can't answer. He wonders why I doubt miracles. I can't give him acceptable reasons. He believes in a personal God. He is therefore justified in allowing that God to do miracles. One of those miracles could logically be the establishment of the church. All of my pointing out of irrationalities or inconsistency does no good. In the first place, he is a clever talker and can find explanations far less far-fetched than the usual kind used for apologetics. In the second place, he can accuse me of trying to make religion rational, which it is not, and I must admit that my kind of religion is more irrational than his. And so we go on to the pointless rounds, he in Australia, I in Chicago. It is good, clean sport and hurts neither of us, although he wants to convince me more than I want to convince him, since according to his doctrine, I am deliberately retarding myself. Still, he does not get dogmatic with me, and he is a great relief from the regular arguments I get on religion. Well, let me read most of what we have. He goes on and on with our time is up, I think, is it? And he goes on and on with quotations, these highly interesting quotations from his journal, which would be very worth reading. Is our time up? You want to stop? You want to hear 5 more minutes? Well, let's stop. All right. Read his last page. Yes, good question. All right, very good. What my practice of rhetorology as a missionary taught me was that if I pretended to listen sympathetically to beliefs I detested, I would sometimes discover that they were better beliefs than those I held when entering the discussion. And even when they did not happen, my hypocrisy upward or outward did at least broaden and deepen my own grasp of the world and of how we limited creatures can deal with its mysteries. I hope it is clear that nothing I've said suggests that all religious or Mormon views, open or disguised, are equally defensible. The point of rhetorological dialogue is not relativistic tolerance, but genuine progress toward truth. Some religious commitments save, some destroy. Some hypocritical efforts to listen can reveal beliefs even worse than they appeared at the beginning. To take in or act out the other with full empathy, learning to think with